want to continue our discussion from this morning about human surfaces, then let me give you a few more examples. So the two sphere with the standard metric is the same as C with infinity added, and it's called the Riemann, sometimes called the Riemann sphere in complex geometry. So by the way, for today, I'm have to stick on this side of the room because of there's nobody manning the camera. I want to explain how you get this by gluing two patches of C together with a coordinate change. So if I take the two sphere minus a north pole, this is conformally equivalent to C by stereographic projection. With this coordinate, call this coordinate Z. And the two sphere minus the south pole, also conformally equivalent to C, again by stereographic projection, in the other way. This is coordinate W. And you can check that W is 1 over Z. So that is, on the region where Z is not equal to 0, we can project in both ways. And the coordinates are related like this. So it's hard to draw a picture, but I mean, I'll try. This is my sphere. I have the plane going through the middle. North pole, there's a south pole. You know, if I take a point over here, if I take a point on the bottom, when I stereographic project from the south, it goes over there, outside the unit circle. But when I do it from the top, it goes inside the unit circle. And these points are related in this way. You should think about it in polar coordinates. You would derive this expression if you really want to. And more generally, with the following theorem of Riemann, every metric on the two sphere is conformally equivalent to the standard. So there is only one Riemann surface, which is topologically the two. Let's do the next example.
How did we see that C union infinity is S2? Did we see that?
You think about the stereographic projection. Let me draw it down here again. This north pole. And when I take a point there, as they get closer to the north pole, they head to infinity. So
to get this point,
you need to adjoin a point at infinity to the plane. But it's easier to see it, to think about, oh, and if to think that to see this point, I need to work in the other coordinate patch where I stereographically project from the south pole, which this point goes to the origin. And then if they're identified by W as 1 over Z, when W is 0, Z is infinity.
Okay. Yeah, got it.
The next example is an elliptic curve. So we know that topologically, the torus looks like this. So it's a square with the sides identified. So we want to think about how to give this a metric. And the way to do it is we have to choose lengths of the sides, and we also have to choose the angle between the two sides. So we give this a metric by choosing some points lambda mu, which are in C. Minus the origin is the same as or 2 minus the origin. And you assume that they're not collinear. And then instead of forming a square, you can form a parallelogram with these sides. That's a lambda mu lambda plus mu and then identify the opposite side, the sides as before. I didn't mean for this to be right angled. All right, let me draw it again. These are vaguely parallel. So this is something you can literally build out of paper. You cut it up, and you do the sides together, and you will get a manifold with a flat metric. But the manifold structure is really different. Like, these are really different manifolds depending on the angle. So we're interested in these guys up to conformal equivalence. So that means I can scale my parallelogram. I'm always allowed to rotate it. That's not going to do anything. But if I scale it, I'll get a conformally equivalent one. So we can always scale and rotate so that mu is 1. Mu is 1. And then lambda goes to lambda over mu, which we call, is traditionally called tau. And we can assume that the imaginary part of tau is bigger than 0. Is that visible up there? Yeah. So what we're saying is, any of these metrics is conformally equivalent to one which looks like this. This is 1, this is tau, I didn't draw the world's greatest parallelogram, but I'm supposed to identify them. That. So as a complex manifold, we can think of this as the complex line where the coordinate z is made periodic. Z is equivalent to z plus 1, and z is equivalent to z plus tau. That's when I go over this way, I come back here. And when I go up this way, like in the tall direction, I come back. So it's a little bit like a circle, except now there's a double period. So in this geometry, holomorphic function is a doubly periodic function. These are called elliptic functions. So for example, how would I make a doubly periodic function? Well, you could do some kind of averaging for something to be periodic. So an example is the Weierstrass-P function, z squared we're going to sum over all integers. Squared minus 1 over so it looks like a complicated expression, but all I've done is taken 1 over z squared and said, okay, that is not periodic, so I force it to be periodic by averaging it over the possible translate. Then you'd worry a little bit about convergence because it's a big infinite sum, and you add on this term to make it converge better. So this is a holomorphic on the elliptic curve with a point removed. So, of course, there are many more examples, and we'll get to some in a minute, but are there any questions about so far?
We didn't give any metric to... We started out to give a metric to the torus, right?
We started life... This torus starts with a metric. From that data, you know about the conformal structure. But the metric is on a patch. It's just literally the metric on the plane.
Okay.
So that's why this is locally a holomorphic coordinate.
So the metric is the same as the plane, except that we are identifying points now.
Okay. Exactly. What's that say? Oh, E is the elliptic curve. I think it's called. E sub tau.
We're just checking the claim. The claim is for every tau, we have a metric, and this is just one by one, right? But for every metric, we can assign a tau. For every tau, I can assign a metric.
I haven't stated that theorem, right? So we saw in the case of a two-sphere, so we said there is only one conformal tau. They're all the same. So for the case of a torus, the statement which is true is that If I give you any metric on a torus, no matter how curved and wacky it is, it's conformally equivalent to one of those. And
but the other side, to be on the other side, for every tau, there is a metric. So it just corresponds.
Yes, so for every tau, there's a metric. But that's easy. You know, I've kind of drawn the metric. So the slightly tricky part is sometimes two different taus give you the same metric. I can give you an example. If you change tau goes to tau plus 1, you always get the same metric. And there's some other transformations like that, which I won't write down. So let me draw. This is really easy, and you see it's just going to be because we're just cutting up the torus in a different way. If I was to build a surface of a tau plus 1, I would have that. Vector be the same. I'd use this vector here. And I need to continue. But all you do is you take this region and glue it over there. So like they're the same thing, just chopped up in different ways.
But why this argument doesn't work for the other point in the middle, for example, tau plus 1 over 2? The similar argument doesn't work. It seems it's...
Yeah. The reason I can do this... It's to do with the way that the regions are identified. A better way to say it is, being periodic under tau and 1 is the same as being periodic under tau plus 1 and 1. So this is the key point. So I'm periodic under two complex numbers, I can rearrange those complex numbers and still have the same periodicity conditions. So the general, tau and tau prime are in the same conformal class. If and only if tau prime is A tau plus B or C tau plus D, where A, B, C, D are integers, and A D minus B C is 1. So this the point is that this constraint is enough to that the two different periodicity conditions are the same. So I didn't want to get too into that, but there's the result.
So but things like if you want to couple a curvature on the torus or something. So I don't get the intuition, because if the metric is the same flat with just identification, it So is the curvature zero?
The curvature is zero, yes. So are you worried, like, why are they not all the same?
Mm-hmm.
Is your concern that they, why are they not all the same if they have zero curvature? Is that the...
It's for all tori, curvature is zero, no matter.
Yes. Well, for all of these flat tori that we're building, the curvature is zero. And the general theorem is on a torus, for any metric, you can perform a veil transformation to make it flat.
A veil transformation flat?
So that it becomes flat.
Okay. But for torus, we can do it globally, right? For torus, you can do it globally.
For a yes, for a torus, you can do it globally. It's always the case you can do it locally, you can make flat, but on a torus, you can do it locally. Any metric on U2 is conformally equivalent to the flat metric for some tall. You can see that these, for different values of tall, these must be different. The reason is, suppose I choose a vector which is periodic. So I go around that vector and I come back to where I started. Then, if I rotate by 90 degrees and I go around, I may or may not come back to where I started. If tall was I, you do. Tall is not I, you don't. So you can distinguish between different values of tall by thinking about, take a periodic direction, rotate by 90 degrees, and seeing where you go. Topic I want to discuss is like how Riemann surfaces arise by thinking about taking square roots and like solving polynomial equations. This is like a really classic topic and kind of the origin of this. So firstly, but on C, the function z goes to root z has a branch cut. So if we write z is or e to the I theta, or theta is between minus pi and pi, the range of theta. It starts at the negative reals. Then we can define root z is or to the half e to the I theta over 2. But with this definition, when we go around the origin, we change sign. So when theta goes from minus pi to pi, change the sign. Because 4th a half e to the minus I pi over 2 is minus 4th a half e to the I. Because the exponent differs by a factor of I pi. Well, I hope this is familiar to people. Look at another example. Consider square root of z times the square root of z minus 1. In the square root of z, you get a branch cut. Root z goes to minus root z. But you also get one, not very distinct. And the square root of z minus 1, root z minus 1 goes to minus root z. So those two branch cuts on this region cancel. That is, as I go from here to here, w is unchanged. There is no branch cut here. But w does have a branch cut. Because here, only the root z minus 1 piece changes, and the other one doesn't change. Oh, looks like zero, 1. And as I go across there, w gets sent to minus. So the claim is going to be that in any situation like this, you know, I could be taking square roots of some complicated polynomial. It could be cube roots. It could be even more complicated. In any situation like this, this function, this coordinate w, is really a coordinate on a new Riemann surface. If you build you try to build a function of a complex variable by taking square roots or by solving a polynomial equation, then in any situation like that, your function is going to be a function on some Riemann surface because of branch cuts. So in this example, this is a really simple example, my function w is perfectly fine on some real axis, in some real region. So I say when z is bigger than 1, because I just take the positive square root of everything. But it has, because of the way it has like two different branch cuts and they combine, when I try to treat it globally, it really lives on a Riemann surface. This is a pretty simple example. But if I had a complicated function, it could be a very complicated Riemann surface that it lives on. So how do we see this? So consider the plane, and I'm going to remove the interval between 0 and 1. I'm going to remove the branch locus. There, on this region, there are two solutions. W squared equals z minus 1. So for each z, there's two w's. And like they don't talk to each other. So just because there's no branch cut, so if I go away from the branch locus, I can choose my two square roots. And even as I wind around the branch locus, they don't mix. So the set of solutions to the equation is then is two copies of the plane with this interval removed. I'm going to draw it like this. It's hard to draw the interval being removed. I'm going to thicken it up a little bit. If there's one copy, and here's the other copy. And these copy represent the two possible branches of my function. But these copies are glued together along the boundary because as I move into the branch cut, we move from one sheet to the other. So we'll draw it like this. As I go in there, I will come out on the other branch. Top. And as I go in here, I'll come out of the other branch at the bottom. So the Riemann surface that it lives on is obtained by taking these two planes and gluing together these boundaries of these intervals in this. However, it's better to include infinity in this because various things. So if we do this, the plane with an interval removed becomes S2 with an interval removed. which you can draw like this. And I've removed this little, you think about, you know, you had a sphere and you made a little cut with the scissors and you separated the two sides. So now we have two copies of this. And we're going to glue them together in the same way. So if you think about it, you'll see, okay, if I take this sphere and I pull it out and I rotate it around, I can stick it on. And the result is a new sphere. So in this case, the Riemann surface for W squared equals Z, Z minus 1 is again a sphere. But that's a little boring. So let's do another example to get something more interesting. Unless, are there any questions?
When we say F is, F lives in a, on a Riemann surface, what do we mean in that? Which, like, this function, ZZ minus 1 under root, what we are saying is defined only on this, on some kind, on the surface of a sphere.
Yes.
Which is maybe holomorphic, which is isomorphic to C minus.
Yes, exactly. Or maybe more formally, suppose I take a function with some square roots, it may be defined on the real axis, then you look for the maximal region you can make it analytic.
Okay.
That will generally be some Riemann surface.
Okay, I see.
Our alternative formal definition is, look at this equation, the set of complex solutions to this equation, because it's, you know, two complex variables and one complex equation, it's some complex curve.
Uh-huh.
That's the Riemann surface.
Because, like, formally, what are we doing when we say include C equals infinity? We're just taking C union infinity and then subtracting at 0, 1.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And what justifies us saying include C equals
infinity? So we it's a reasonable thing to do as long as there's no branch cuts going to infinity. Because if there were branch cuts going to infinity, then you might think that, like, one of these little strips you'd have to remove might include infinity. You could also think about it from this perspective. We look at the solution, these equations, there's like an algebraic way to using projective space to include infinity. Let's do another example. Suppose I look at the equation where I define W as root C minus 1, C minus 2, root Z minus 3. And here the branch structure looks like between 0 and 1, I have a branch cut. Between 2 and 3 of a branch. So this is because each of these four points has a branch cut going off to infinity. When I cross it, I pick up a minus sign. But when there's an even number of those branch cuts meeting, they all count. So as I cross here, W goes to minus W, the same thing as I cross here. So, same argument. Now consider the two sphere minus two intervals. And w is a function on the Riemann surface made by gluing two copies.
It's a torus.
Exactly, it's a torus. No, it's not.
I've been taken on this dirty union.
As usual, it's something that's easier to draw on. And we're going to kind of picking up these little strips, you know, imagine cutting them out and stretching them. So it's the same kind of thing. As I cross this branch, I'm going to go to the other sheet. Across this branch, I go to that. So the top of one sheet, the top of one cut is glued to the bottom of the cut on the other sheet. And when we glue, we get something torus topologically. So this is actually the origin of the theory of elliptic curves and so on. People took a function like that involving square roots and they wanted to integrate it. And they found it was very complicated, and the result of the integral was expressed in terms of doubly periodic functions. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sorry. You have a question? I was just going to ask the follow up on that statement. Is the conclusion then that you can integrate it as if you're integrating on a torus?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I get about the integration thing, but we're talking about two copies of one manifold. So if two copies of that is a conformally flat space times or manifold in general, can we just what can we say for one of them?
That's a really good question. So what's happening is that you might be arguing that look, the two sphere is curved. This is also curved, but the torus is flat. So how can that be? What happens is when I glue these things together, I get a singularity. And that singularity is one unit of negative curvature, which can cancel against the positive curvature of the rest of the sphere. Did I explain this? It's fun to think about the curvature of spaces you get by gluing flat things together with singularities. So I was to glue this to this. So we get something singularity at cross point. So the curvature is, one definition is the relationship between the area of a triangle and the length of the sides. Right, so flat, the area, you know, is half the base times the height. Negative, the area is less than that. And positive, the area is bigger than that. So you can see this, that's flat, negatively curved, looks like that. And positively curved, it kind of bows out, like on the surface of a ball. So what you do here is you draw a triangle and you measure its area and you compare it to the formula in Euclidean geometry. And you find that it's less than that. Than you would expect. This is like so fun. I'm just going to go off topic and do it. Here's how you do it. I'm going to do a hexagon instead. It doesn't really matter. Branch cut. This is a hexagon of side length 1. Why is it a hexagon? When I go around, I come up with this other one. This picture gives a hexagon. The area, obviously, is the area of two equilateral triangles. But in Euclidean space, the area is 36 equilateral triangles. So therefore, it's negatively curved. Let me just get my notes again. What was I going to do? Ah, yes. So we see that when we look at the function with, can I erase it? Sorry. We saw that if we look at the function w is root z minus 1, z minus 2, root z minus 3, we get 2 torus. But we know that all conformal structures on the two torus are e tall for some tall. Now, how are these two things related? E tall. So for this to work, all we need is we need a holomorphic map from E tau to the Riemann sphere, which is 2 to 1. So that for each point in the Riemann sphere, there are two different branches. And which has 4 points where the branches come together. Let's explain how to build such a thing. So recall we had the virus SP function, and I wrote down an expression with this, and it's doubly periodic. And as a double pole at the origin. So that's not really what we want, but we define a map from the elliptic curve to the plane of the CP1 by sending z equals to 1 over the virus SP function. And this will be the thing you want. But maybe this is a bit too analytical to be helpful. Let's try to understand the geometry of this a little better. E of z. It's an even function, g of minus z. So the two branches are related by z goes to minus. That is, if I'm on one branch, then applying minus z will take me to the other branch. So this suggests that the Riemann sphere, CP1, can be obtained in the torus by identifying z with minus z. And that's good. That's true, and we'll see it. One is the elliptic curve modulo the relation where z is equivalent to minus. So to see this, draw a picture point here is tau over 2. If you think about it for a minute, you'll see. Now, I want to identify, you know, things are going to be equivalent under these relations. That goes to z plus 1. That goes to z plus tau. That goes to minus c. So using these relations, we can always move z to the shaded region. Region here. Because if it was up here, then I send z goes to minus z, it goes down there. I use the other relations to shift it back to this region. So whatever I get by this equivalence relation is going to be obtained by taking this region and identifying the boundaries in some way. Now, this point is fixed. So tau over 2 plus a half is fixed under z goes to minus z. And if we're up here, like tau over 2 plus something gets sent to tau over 2 plus a half, 1 minus that. But something on this line gets sent over there. Similarly, that we get. A, B, B. So this, yeah, this is just a piece of paper that you folded to the sides together. People call it a pillow. But clearly it's the two sides. And the four special points are the four corners. That. So in this way, we kind of geometrically see, if you believe that this is conformally equivalent to the T-sphere, although it has a funny metric, you can really see geometrically how the elliptic curve arrives as a cover, as a twofold cover. Any questions about this construction?
No. What we did was the set. I see that the middle line things are getting mapped on the, say, the reflection about the middle axis, but is the same thing happening at the bottom?
The bottom, I think, is wrong. That's arrow should be.
That arrow should be this way. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, because if I take z and put over there, it gets sent over there, and then gets shifted up there.
But I didn't understand something. Where the transformation z to minus z comes, where it comes from?
Ah, so when we started, and I look at this equation, w squared is something, something, then w goes to minus w is a symmetry of the geometry. And I wanted to find that symmetry here. And I said, well, okay, w should be the virus p function or something. W should be this coordinate, and using terminal notation, the mapping is given by the virus p function. So I need to find some symmetry preserved by the virus recipe. Or more, I mean, just more generally, you could say, when I start life, I know I have a symmetry sending w to minus w. So if I just look at my torus, what possible symmetries do I have? This is the only one. So we could forget about the virus recipe function and say, okay, there must be some involution, I guess it's z goes to minus z, such that when I identify things using this, I get the two sphere. And we've checked that it is indeed the two.
Okay.
From this point of view, the tricky thing is I've found something which is topologically the two-sphere. The result of Riemann tells us it must be conformally equivalent to the two-sphere. How do we write that down? That's the part in which you need to use a virus SP.
I'm not confused. This, why are we saying this is the two-sphere? It shouldn't be the torus.
Once I put on this additional equivalence relation, it becomes the two-sphere. That's the argument. That's what we're trying to argue here.
So, but then this tells us that for that all the functions that we wrote, the Riemann surface is a two-sphere with four special points.
Yeah. So I'm saying exactly. No. For the function w squared equals square root thing, we thought the Riemann surface was an elliptic curve, and it had a mapping to the two-sphere. And it was a mapping which preserved sending w to minus w.
Okay. Oh.
So we take the w plane, whatever surface it is, and identify w with minus w, we should get the two-sphere.
Okay.
That's what we're trying to see here.
Okay.